Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Best of the season, Rick.
Well, season's greetings to you, Jim, and thanks for inviting me on.
The stock market just keeps wanting to climb higher and higher. What is propelling it, and how long is this propellant going to last?
Well, it's mostly short covering. If you look at any stock that has made substantial gains, you'll see that probably 90% of those gains have been made on short squeeze opening bars. In other words, you've got a lot of market orders to buy that come in on the opening every day. And when the specialists in that situation, when they're opening at a given price to meet that overnight demand, they can pick any price they like. So generally, you see gaps on stocks, and everything's moving higher. You know, I think that the insanity is at just about a peak right now.
Now, you said you had some indicators you were watching, and when we hit one of them, it's time to grab your parachute.
Yeah, I think it's no more difficult than watching Microsoft. I used to say the same about Apple, but I think that Apple is no longer the perfect stock because it's very vulnerable in a recession. You know, with all the overpriced iPhones that they sell, it's already hit in China. You know, Apple sales in China are way off. That hasn't really dawned on investors, mostly institutions. I wouldn't call them investors because they've just been on kind of buy and hold, and the upward movement in the stock has been, I guess, partially driven by Apple's purchase of its own stock, but also the short covering factor where every day begins with a short squeeze. And you can understand where if a stock's trading Microsoft, let's say, around 190, and it opens the next day at 192, it's taken no stock changed hands in that $2 gap. So there was no money expended to push the stock up $2. And yet those $2 account for many, many billions of dollars added to the quote-unquote store of wealth on call it the global asset ledger. But it's all fake money. It's just a lot of hot air. But I think Microsoft is much better positioned than Apple because as you and all of us billions of users of the Windows operating system know, they put all of the revenues on a subscription basis. And so even if you're not going to buy a new iPhone every 2 years now, you're going to renew your Microsoft 365 subscription. So Microsoft has they're just about bomb-proof. So many people will renew automatically their Windows operating system and Outlook and the other things that come with it. So it's really, I think, the bluest of blue-chip stocks in the whole world right now. So it stands to reason that if Microsoft keeps going higher, it's going to pull the entire market higher or certainly keep other stocks buoyant. And in that respect, you know, the chart is pretty simple. It's not rocket science. Microsoft looks like it's very likely to get to $430 a share. That would be up from a current 370 or so. It's been kind of jacking around at 370, and the ascent, the final ascent to 430, has been slower than I expected. The only risk I see in this prediction is that everything will turn down and the market will crash before Microsoft makes it quite up to 430. But if it does get it up there, it's not going any higher without a very significant correction, by which I mean to imply a major bear market like no one alive has ever seen.
Apple used to be your top pick. Why are you not so hot on Apple anymore?
Because they've lost their ability to innovate. They couldn't innovate their way out of a wet paper bag anymore. Steve Jobs would be rolling over in his grave. Their idea of innovation is to add another 10 or 15 or 50 features to the iPhone camera, which we all need new features on that, like we need a hole in the head. And their hardware is always been overpriced, and I think that will make it more vulnerable in a recession. You know, you've already got a slowdown, a very significant slowdown of iPhone sales in China, and it's impacting on revenues, if not on the dim brains of institutional investors who have basically been buy and hold in Apple for the last umpteen years.
They also have a problem with their watch, some kind of patent dispute.
Yeah, they had a challenge to patents that make it that they can no longer sell, I guess, certain watches in the U.S. And this is, of course, hitting. I'm not sure whether it's going to fully impact Christmas sales, but it was a real body blow, and I don't see any really interesting stories coming out of Apple again because they've lost their ability to innovate. They do have things they sell besides iPhones, but iPhones are the main source of Apple's revenue.
Yeah, power cords that break.
Well, there, you know, the Europeans beat Apple into submission because the charger cords for Apple for the iPhone were different from everybody else's, and even though American, I don't know under whose jurisdiction that would fall, but Europe sort of ganged up on Microsoft and said you're going to make a C-type connection like everybody else. So Apple sort of grudgingly went along with it, and I think they even spun it in the way they usually do, which is, hey, check out this new innovation in Apple. They're moving to a standard charger cord. Big deal.
Hmm. How's Facebook going to get through all this, Meta?
Facebook just took an enormous blow. You know, Zuckerschmuck just took the entire company a few years ago an entirely different direction. And, of course, if you missed the point, he renamed the company Meta. I still use Facebook because that's what it is to me. But, you know, his idea was that virtual goggles were going to dominate the retail world, that everybody was going to own virtual goggles and eventually come to live in a goggle world. And this is a little bit different from other virtual reality goggle models, because within Facebook, he would, I guess, centralize the experience and sort of grow it in different ways from Facebook servers. But the other way of looking at virtual goggle future is in packages, entertainment packages that would come separately, that would not all be under the aegis of Facebook. So everybody's kind of rethinking that, and in the meantime, they've all sort of picked up on AI, artificial intelligence. But I would challenge anybody really to describe some way in which AI has improved their lives. I think It's hugely overhyped, and it's not only a source of buying for the major tech companies of their stocks, the AI story, so to speak, but even way far afield from that, you know, in San Francisco, some guy bought an office building that at $100 million discount from its previous sale. And we've talked about this before. It's a Spear Street building, a good property in downtown San Francisco. And it was on the books for tax purposes at $140 million. It changed hands for $40 million. And initially I thought, well, I'm not going to go too hard on this guy. It was an East Indian guy with an investment company. And I figured if he's got $40 million to put in a billion into the building and another $50 million to refurbish it, he must have some smarts. But when the punchline was, when he gets to the end of his story about why he bought the building, it was the idea that AI was going to bring San Francisco back, that it was going to fill up all the office buildings, including the Salesforce Tower and everything else. And that sort of drove home the point that even sharp real estate investors are a little mentally retarded when it comes to AI's future. Hmm. When I look, I'm really, really down on AI because I'm on the phone a lot. You know, I use my business uses a lot of different applications and a lot of I'm always talking to software companies, third-party vendors and things, and they can never get it straight. You can't get the most basic problem solved on the phone, and AI can't even handle spell check, let alone FAQs and tech support for various devices and services. So AI is being kind of touted as a miracle remedy. It's going to increase productivity. But who the hell cares about productivity when things are so fundamentally screwed up that the whole system is verging on collapse? You know, I would cite the auto insurance business as a good example. You know, you could, in theory, bring AI to the inventory, parts inventory, and just-in-time shipment of auto parts. But the bigger picture in collision repair, for one, is that they can't get the parts. The parts are getting ridiculously expensive, and the insurance companies are 3 or 4 years behind the curve in raising their insurance prices. So here's the auto insurance industry. You're going to be reading about the implosion of that industry sometime in the next year. And my information comes from a guy who's got a big auto body shop out in the Bay Area. You know, but they're dead ducks. And the idea that you could tweak inventory or do whatever AI is expected to do falls so short of the problem. And I would say you go into any industry, and whether it's hotels, restaurants, amusement parks, you name it, I cannot imagine really what AI is going to do for it to improve the bottom line other than maybe slightly marginally.
Well, of course, AI, they say, well, it learns, but right now then you'd be hiring somebody in grade one. Can barely spell its name.
Uh-huh. Well, and when you use the word hiring, that's a fundamental problem with AI. Wherever AI actually does work, it absolutely, explicitly guarantees that you're going to have fewer people doing these jobs. You know, and I guess from the ideal standpoint, from the AI side of it, you're going to get that high school grad to be doing the work that's done by a courtroom lawyer. And I know we read about how AI can write all that legal boilerplate, but the boilerplate already exists. It just needs changing for each client, so I don't think that's any great shakes that AI can do better at boilerplate than whoever's doing it now. But the fact is, at a hypothetical level, you could put an AI machine in a courtroom and give it a pair of ears, and it should argue a defendant's case with recourse to the entire law library. You know, that would be the theoretical potential of AI in a courtroom. It has the entire law library at its disposal, and apparently, or at least in theory, the ability to reason out the logic of case law to make the best possible case for a client. But and that's the theoretical, but I can't imagine the monkeys who do most of the AI programming coming to that point of getting putting on a great defense or prosecution with AI total recall on case law.
And what happens to all the people displaced by AI? Of course, they suggest, well, they'll go on to some other career. But so many things are covered by AI. Where do you go?
Well, the only solution there, and I hate to say anything good about Bill Gates, because I think he's one of the maybe top five villains in this world, but his idea about taxing robots would come in handy with AI. You know, everybody who loses a job to AI should be subsidized by some tax that's placed on the business users of AI. You know, business takes five people off its payroll and substitutes AI should pay some sort of tax. Actually, I'm not pro-tax in any sense of the word, so I guess I'm not going to argue that so vehemently, but at least in theory, it's a solution. Gates is the plan about let's tax robots, because if they're going to put people out of jobs, the employers who are doing the laying off should pay a price. So otherwise, we're going to have a lot of people living off welfare, whatever. So so Gates's logic, I think, is very good there.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, if the market makes a dramatic downturn in the not-too-distant future, are there any safe havens, any places that you think would be good?
No. None that you can be absolutely confident in. And I say that after having talked about it with some people I would describe as the smartest survivalists I know. You know, one has been buying 1,000-ounce bars of silver for years, and he doesn't flinch when the price comes down. He just buys more of it, and he's got he's actually got a plot of land somewhere, 6 acres, that has never been fertilized. There has never been any pesticide put on this property, and it's just good, arable, pristine land, and that's his worst case. You know, that's his, I'm not going to say ace in the hole. It might wind up being like a 7 or 8 in the hole. But that's the worst case, is being able to grow your own food. Because so you're going to find that the distribution network that gets food into big cities is going to break down like everything else when the market collapses and the financial system comes unraveled, which is, in my mind, certain to do. And I don't mean in years and years and years. You know, my focus, as I mentioned to you earlier, is I'm using a 430 target Microsoft, and when it gets there, I think that's the fat lady singing. So where have you got your money squirreled away? There's no guarantee of safety, and even there's something really interesting that's made quite a hit on the web in the last few weeks. It's called The Great Taking. The author is a guy named David Webb Rogers, and I'm sorry, David Rogers Webb, and he talks about the subtle, he doesn't talk about it, he gives you the actual word changes that have been made to change property laws so that we no longer really own securities. There was always this thing about, well, I hold stock certificates, but they're in street name. They're not titled in your name. But it's gotten a lot worse than that, because of these very deliberate changes by an elite few who mean to trigger all of the world's assets into their greedy, slimy hands. So what's happened, this fellow, Rogers Webb, he lays it out. I mean, he takes the actual wording of these laws that have been recoded so that we no longer own property, especially securities, certificates, or even government bonds. We have what's called a security entitlement, and that makes quite a difference, because in the great financial collapse that's coming, all the assets will get sort of triggered into one pool, and these laws, which have been endorsed by, I think, 21 members of the European coalition, endorsed in a way that not one person in 10 million in the rank and file could tell you what's actually happened. But the changes, they supersede even bankruptcy, the federal bankruptcy laws, so that when assets are taken in a bankruptcy, this entity holds them. And of course, the story that will be put out to you, the former owner of these things, is that we'll sort things out, and you know we'll get these assets back to you as soon as we can. But the one unusual feature of the bankruptcy laws is they've been the laws that supersede bankruptcy is that the assets that are seized in bankruptcy are not they're not valued. In other words, no one takes the time to say, well, this asset's worth this much and that is worth that much. They're all sort of put into a big pool, and this law further provides that the assets in the pool can be divvied up on a pro rata basis by them, that's a capital T, and so the bottom line is, the car in your garage and the refrigerator that you're making payments on in your house, you may own them, but you really don't, because the dealer who sold them to you may be or probably is encumbered in this derivatives market, $2 quadrillion worth, that amounts to as much as, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20 times global GDP. So all the assets are tied up. And they are essentially seized by a central, call it a clearing firm or a clearing agency. And it's really scary the way some of these rules were rewritten. Webb Rogers takes a lot of time in the first 30 pages of this book to explain exactly which rules were changed, and he relates a story of his own that he saw this thing coming. He's a really seasoned financier. He really knows the world of finance. He mentions having had a meeting with George Soros. Soros summoned him, and they were talking about something, and Rogers Webb said, well, you know, we would just do this. And Soros said, no, you don't know how they are going to react. So it was kind of funny that even in the life of George Soros, who's right up there in my book with Gates, as far as a plotter, schemer, conspirator, there's a they in his life, too. You know, someone who sits above his level, who is in a controlling position that he evidently excludes himself from. So anyway, they were talking about it's just remarkable who has written these laws, how few people were involved to change the laws. But as the bottom line of this entire book is that their property rights have been turned upside down. We no longer technically own property if there's a legal taking.
Hmm. So stocking up with gold, is that going to protect my butt in bad times?
unless you think back to 1933 when, you know, everybody thought gold would be great until Roosevelt confiscated it. And, you know, with the banking collapse of 1933, it has been said wrongly over history since then that Roosevelt's fireside chats and the bank holiday was what saved the banking system from complete collapse. But if you look at the details, the banks didn't all reopen. It was only banks that had the sanction of the Federal Reserve, and I don't even want to get into that. You know, I'm going to suggest that your listeners read the Creature from Jekyll Island to know why the Fed was created and what its creators have been doing since. You know, the book quotes, and ironically, a statement made by Bernanke. You know, Bernanke was talking, obviously, long after the fact, 100 years after, or 90 years after, about how he finally admitted that Fed tightness had definitely exacerbated the plunge into the Great Depression of the 1930s. And but Bernanke was intending that in a way. He said, well, you know, we learned our lessons from the 1930s, and we won't make the same mistakes again. But Rogers Webb deconstructs that and basically said any lessons learned will be used to make sure that the seizure of assets is more complete and more successful than it was in the 1930s. And you know, he raises the hypothetical question, well, why did the rich have to pull their kids out of private schools in the 30s? And the answer is because even the ordinary rich and super rich, they didn't suspect that the banking system was going to collapse in a way that, not all of them had their money in sanctioned banks, in banks that reopened. And, of course, the ones that did, that were holding mortgage paper or mortgage paper that they bought, holding the deeds to homes, they very generously leased them back to the homeowners. You know, your home was taken in bankruptcy. Many people lost their homes in the 30s. And the banks took them and said, look, we'll rent the house back to you, but only until we can find a decent buyer. And the decent buyer really didn't come along for more than 20 years, but because by the early 1950s, many of the assets that had been seized in the 30s were still trading at only half the value that they'd had in the 1930s. And the book makes, as an example, a going concern, a big business that was started and grew in Cleveland. You know, that was a family business for the author. So coming back to the seizure that's coming and how they're going to take everything, they with a capital T, the question is, well, do they really want my car and my refrigerator? Mm. And the answer is no, but the way that the laws that will essentially give effect the great taking, the way they've been written, they just didn't want to leave any holes. They wanted to make sure that they got all the assets, and that meant essentially putting into place wording that supervenes bankruptcy law and everything else. So the refrigerators and cars that would technically go to this one, transfer from being your entitlement security to someone else's property to distribute as they see fit, it's for reasons of the conspirators not wanting to leave any loose collateral around, because wherever there is collateral, there will be challenges to the taking agency. And they've already sort of done a test run with COVID. And you know, the question was, if people are spooked enough about this disease that's going to kill them, how much can we order them around? How crazy can it get? How many crazy things can we get them to do? you know, masking up and shutting down businesses. And that experiment was so successful that, you know, they have, let's say, a much better game plan this next time around.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
That's about it, Jill. I think we covered it all, and I know it's not, it doesn't sound very Merry Christmas, but it is reality, and I think for reasons of my Microsoft target being so close, I have to think that the big one may not be so far off.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Jim. I appreciate a chance to connect with your audience.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.